Welcome to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for choosing to join us again for another episode of our weekly dive into the wonderful creative mind, or in this instance, minds of those people involved in celebrating and just rejoicing in that beautiful relationship between film and music. And I'm really thrilled about having, I don't know, these two together, because it's, well, they spend a lot of time together because they're family, but in terms of working together, they don't do that much together. Our latest guests on Soundtracking are not only composers, but they're brothers who between them have built up an extraordinary body of work for both film and television. Indeed, it's on the small screen that Harry and Rupert Gregson-Williams have joined forces for only the second time on Julian Fellowes' New York high society drama, The Gilded Age. We'll talk about that and several of the other projects they've been involved with, including Catch 22 with George Clooney. But first, a word from our good friends at Skillshare. Now, you know that with every episode and every interview I do for this show, I love how much I learn. I'm so keen to fuel my knowledge with the extraordinary insights from the brilliant guests that we have on the show. Well, Skillshare is the world's largest online learning community for creativity. It offers you the inspiration and opportunity to learn new skills, find new ways of putting your talents to use, and empowering you to reach your full potential. Now, I've been taking full advantage of several of the classes, be that looking at how to best utilise social media or trying to improve my scriptwriting skills, as well as something more personal like the powers and importance of things like meditation. There really is an impressive array of opportunities to explore at all levels. The incredible range of classes on offer are a really good way to tap into something that you might already be interested in or find that new side to yourself. There's a real sense of community also with the classes, which is a great level of interaction with fellow members and teachers. The commitment is totally in your hands with monthly, annual, or an unlimited plan all on offer. Now, as part of our wonderful Soundtracking family, how would you like to start your journey with a 1 month free trial? Explore your creativity at skillshare.com/sound and get a month free trial. That's 1 month free at skillshare.com/sound. And so to Harry and Rupert. And as is customary, we'll begin with a cue from their latest collaboration, The Gilded Age. This is I'm Going Home. Thank you so much for doing this. This is lovely. Listen, I don't know where to start with you both, to be honest, but I guess the question is, you know, you've worked together not that much. What makes the decision or what encourages you to work on a project together as opposed to, you know, doing your own individual wonderful things?
Shall I take that one, Ru?
You take it.
I'll take the baton. Yeah. I like this one because it's, no, well, as you've alluded to, Rupert and I did the George Clooney miniseries called Catch 22 a few years ago. Now,
love
I can't
that.
Remember how we got to do that, but we did. We were signed up for that and we had a really good time. I mean, there's nothing not to like about George Clooney. There were kind of two bits of score for that. There was kind of a more contemporary feel to it, and there was plenty of kind of Glenn Millery kind of influenced music. And That's not my strong suit. I had to look to my baby brother for that. I'd have been a bit marooned had I been alone on that one. A little marooned, so to speak. Anyhow, we knew we didn't kill each other doing that. We had a good time, to be honest. And then when this came around in a funny old way, we don't have the same agent. And my agent called me and said, look, you've been long listed. And then about a week later, you've been shortlisted for this thing. And, you know, it's Julian Fellows. You really want to consider it. So I said, well, how long's the shortlist? And he said, well, there's only two other composers on it. One of them's your bloody brother. So I said, oh dear. Who's the
awkward.
Third person? It was potentially going to be. So it turned out the third person, who's a very good, very well-known and very good TV composer, who's probably a bit more qualified to do it than either Rune or me. But I called Rune and said, look, why don't we just outmaneuver this bloke and do it together? And, you know, they get two for the price of one. So that's how that came about.
Oh, would you say then that you both have your kind of, you bring different things to the table almost in a way in terms of you have different strengths?
Yeah, for sure. And with Catch-22, it was definitely, well, we both handled orchestral business, but I as Harry alludes to, he did the hip hop beats and I did the tenor saxophone from 1940 is what he was trying to say. But it wasn't quite like that. But
Rupert's had a little slant towards the towards that stuff. And in all seriousness, you have, haven't you? You know.
Yeah. No. I've always liked playing the wrong note and playing it confidently, which I guess is jazz, isn't it?
It's a great way to describe it.
Yeah, no, we both jumped to the chance, to be honest and serious for a moment. We did, you know, it being written by Julian and his track record. I've always loved that film, Gosforth Park. And I can't remember who did the score for that, but it was someone rather good, Roo.
Was it Paddy? Paddy Doyle, maybe?
Might have been someone like that. Someone rather good who definitely knows the way around. I remember liking the score for that. And so on this one, when we were brought on together, it being during lockdown, it actually didn't make much difference to us because Oops is in the UK and I'm here in LA, and we would have had to have done what we'd have had to done anyhow, which is to share ideas over the internet. And actually the filmmakers are in New York anyhow. So even if both Rue and I had been here in LA, we had the same thing happen.
It's an interesting thing though, isn't it? When we let each other into each other's worlds, because we're very much, you know, the bosses of our world. We have a system that we've sort of got going over quite a few years, and now suddenly you sort of crash into somebody else's space.
That's a good
and,
expression.
And it could be a disaster, I guess. But now actually, with the practice on Catch-22, that it made this fun, and we, you know, I'm sure we did bring different. Harry's a lyrical writer, and on this one probably I was more rhythmic and he was more lyrical. Maybe the next time I'll be more lyrical and he'll be more rhythmic. I don't know, we bring different colors.
We did share the load, which was fun. And I mean, how we set out was Michael Engler was our sort of point person, and he was a showrunner, and he I think he probably directed four or five of the episodes, so he was very involved. And from the start he didn't, you know, although it was Julian, he didn't really, he wanted something, they were looking for something a little different to the Oh, bloody hell, what's that series called?
Downton Abbey.
That little series, yes.
So he thought that, you know, they were wondering, was there something we could do that wasn't just your old string quartet and a harp? And what could be appropriate? And also felt that that succeeded in its own way, musically and filmically, and the storytelling and all that. Obviously, the writing's really brilliant with Julian. But they wanted something a bit more punchy for this and something quite dynamic. So whereas it is sort of an upstairs, downstairs story, this, you know, there are servants, so-called, and butlers and whatnot, who have their own storylines. And then, of course, the people upstairs. But the main dynamic was actually the new money and the old money. So
yeah.
That's two powerful families. But they're powerful in different ways. And how could we express that?
I love how there is a real kind of almost contemporaneous to the whole show, I think, even though it's a period piece. You know, you look at some of the costume designs and things like that, and they've got a real kind of almost a Vivian Westwood kind of twist to them in some places and things. And I think that kind of feels the same in the music at times as well. Obviously, it's a period, and you have that kind of diegetic music as well within there as well, don't you, where there's kind of when they're at dances and balls and there's music going on and things like that, but it still has a really edge to it, which I really love. And I guess that part of that is because it's set, or where it's set,
and it's really a positive and a new time where everybody's looking to the future and they're industrialists taking the world over. And it's not like doing The Crown was a world of sort of disappearing talent, and It was dissolving into nothing. This is actually looking to the future and what can we do that's great, and there's no ends and bounds. And so it's lots of energy to the music for that reason, probably.
from a musical point of view, we were able to sort of mix the new and the old. You know, we weren't going to have anything that stuck out like a sore thumb, but we were able to create a sound palette that wasn't limited to a conventional orchestra. Having said that, you know, I've got hats off to HBO because there's a lot of music. It was a good job though, two pairs of hands on this because there were 10 episodes, 9 or 10 episodes, and each of them is an hour. And you know, when it's HBO, that is an hour of TV. It's not 45 minutes with 50 minutes of ads. It is an hour of TV. So quite often there would be 45 minutes of score, and that's multiplied by 10. And the pace with which the episodes would come to us, we'd have to look at them. We'd then discuss the music, what was expected there, go away and write it. But we'd probably already be recording the previous episode. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we'd be mixing the one that was before that and delivering that. So there was a big turnover. It was quite a lot of pace to the whole proceedings.
Like that kind of, I guess, the opportunity that a series kind of gives you. I mean, you've both kind of had that experience and different genres of things as well, like Rupert with something like Veep, you know, in terms of going over a huge sort of a lot of episodes, but do you like that kind of opportunity for, you know, there almost not being an end point really in terms of whilst you're writing the music? Sound. Yeah.
I don't know.
Infinity soundtrack. Just kidding.
it takes a lot out of you, actually. There's a lot of energy and there's a once you get onto that wheel of deliveries, you've really got to have all your ducks in a row. So luckily we had a couple of months or at least a month probably of creative fun and games. We got all the business out of the way, and then you get onto the hamster wheel of delivery. And so if you know coming back to it every year, then you have to find a different way of creatively giving it a bit of spice, something new. Otherwise you'll just be returning to a hamster wheel, which you don't really want to do.
We had a month or two initially to express ourselves and to try things and to share music with, particularly with Michael Engler and producer Gareth Neame, who is kind of a conduit to Julian, away from the picture. So that was really helpful. And that's what we created the main theme away from the picture, a lot of the thematic material. Although it was, they were a bit mean in sharing episodes. I think we'd only seen like 3 or 4 episodes.
Oh, wow.
And we were wondering whether are there more characters to come or what's going to happen with this story arc. But then, yes, as you say, the floodgates opened and it gave us a rough cut of all the episodes and we knew what we were dealing with. But having got our thematic material together and shared it with them, had some comments and feedback back and forth a little bit, and then we kind of felt we knew where the music needed to be. And then it was, as Rupert said, it's more of the sort of functional going about trying to score scenes. And unless we, you know, make some grave mistake by, you know, that's more a less creative part of the task. I think that the main thing for us was to find the language initially away from the picture. Mm. And then we could set about scoring each of the episodes. Mm.
like when there's a kind of there's a landscape for the music. Is it does it is it easier when it's that kind of not when it's a not necessarily a just a period piece, but when there's if there's a landscape musically, or is it kind of nice that you get the opportunity to kind of fight against that in some ways, or how does it?
You know, the Rubes has done more episodic TV than I, and he's probably more used to that the sort of journey from the beginning of episode one to the end of episode 10 or whatever it is. And obviously, Rube does films as well, and he'll know as well as I do that, you know, with a film, there may be several storylines and arcs that one's kind of tracking, but there's just one film in front of you, so it's kind of easier to keep track of where that is.
Yeah,
when new episodes are popping up unexpectedly.
And actually, with Julian's scripts, you find yourself the pace and the rhythm of your writing. You notice the way he writes much mm-hmm. more so than a lot of screenwriters. There's a lot of timing. You know, you can feel when he's going to set up a comment that's going to take you on to the next. Right. And you have to be. It's quite interesting as a composer. You have to not score that every time. If you do that, you find you're bouncing between scenes. So you have to let them do the speaking, and the music doesn't. And then, luckily, there's moments where the music can speak. But Julian's a very he's a very rhythmic, and momentum is his thing.
Yeah,
so he pushes you on. You know,
was your house and childhood very musical then? In the fact that you, as brothers, you both ended up, you know, being composers.
What?
Yeah, we used to get wheeled out at Christmas, and like my dad would come and wake us up. Well, Harry was probably already awake, so much older than me, but we'd get wheeled out, and he can play. Well, listen, here's the quartet, and we'd be in our pajamas, and we'd do it, and then sent off to bed again. That's kind of my memory of it. You might have a more pleasant one.
Well, there was plenty of that, but we you know, there's plenty of that, but we, you know, our sister plays music too, and so there was always music going on in the house. And as Rup said, our dad was very keen indeed, and he was an artistic director of music festivals up and down the country. So any cathedral city that would have him, it seemed like York, Salisbury, Chichester, Exeter, all over the shop. Really, he was bringing in musicians from all over the world, actually. Mm. I mean, I remember waking up once thinking, blimey, Dad's piano playing's improved. And only to find out that it was Vladimir Ashkenazi hammering out something at breakfast. Yeah.
Yeah, practicing on
I thought, no, that's not the old man. He's really got stuck in bar four. But so there was plenty of music. And our mum, who's still with us, God bless her, she was very much an artist and very interested in music. So yeah, we were surrounded by music.
Lovely. There is something magical about cathedrals. My oldest goes to King's in Gloucester, and so Gloucester Cathedral is part of his the school's campus, and he's in the chapel choir. And oh my God, it was so moving going to the first concert and even the rehearsal and just being in that space and hearing it. And I've been in churches and things before, but I don't know, there's something about that space, and I remember the conversation we had on the way home, kind of thing, and it was so lovely hearing him talk about how physical experience it had felt for him, how emotional he felt hearing them sing in this church, and how it felt to sing in this church, and it was lovely.
I think it is something about the hallowed space, you know, whether you're a believer or not, you know, to be singing in this natural acoustic and with a natural beauty that a cathedral that's perhaps built 400 years before. Yeah, there's something about that atmosphere. And so I think it's something from a compositional point of view, whenever the opportunity arises for me, I'm kind of chasing that.
Yeah.
That the feeling that a lot of that gave.
Yeah. Harry and I were both choristers, and it's definitely affects the way I feel harmony and just the way to deliver music is definitely from a choral perspective a lot of the time for me.
Rupert, I really enjoyed the Behind Her Eyes. I thought the score for that was really wonderful. It was such a kind of bonkers show, but brilliant. Bonkers, but brilliant. But I just loved the journey of the score on that. I thought it was great.
Thank you. Yeah, it was completely crazy, wasn't it? And, let's face it.
I mean, that as a compliment.
Yeah. I told you that someone keeps, as a friend of mine, keeps saying to me, oh, you did that such a great show. And I'm like, are you sure it was me? And it turns out it was you. It's
I get called, that.
Is it The Prince? Yes. Is it called, so called
No, don't. No, thank you.
I haven't seen
that
it.
One up.
But that, I keep being complimented.
That got cancelled. But no, I get that too. You know,
you
my favorite
and I get
melody ever.
I've actually had your royalties before.
Yeah, no, yeah. People like that. Your stuff. That's good to know.
And since we last spoke, actually, Harry, House of Gucci. Oh my God, that was so
mad as well, wasn't it?
So mad, but so entertaining.
Right? Yeah, I thought so. I was, you know, I was naturally a bit disappointed. You know, when push came to shove, my contribution to it was I've never had so little music in a movie, and I don't say that on this occasion. It wasn't because I failed so badly. It's because there was no space.
Did you start off with lots? No,
mate. That was the thing. What you mean? Yeah, it went from 80-minute score down to 8 minutes. No, it's not one of those. It isn't. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't fill me with shame. It just fills me with a slight regret that I can't, you know, like Edith saying she enjoyed it. It's a mad blast. And it is.
So good.
I'm happy to have been associated with it, but really, Ridley was really didn't need that much music from me, and I'm not used to that feeling. Definitely not from a Scott brother. I mean, you know, really, the scores are from 70 minutes of music up to in excess of 100 minutes in Kingdom of Heaven or The Martian. So to be asked, really, you know, I think I probably wrote 6 or 7 pieces cues, and in 3 or 4 of those spots, it was to try and replace a song. I wasn't asked to, but I felt like I wanted to try. And it, you know, I did. You can't really argue with a Debbie Harry song.
It's hard.
Like, that's all right, mate. We'll go with the David Bowie. But thanks. We'll keep your 2 or 3 little bits here. That's how that was.
Conscious effort or kind of decision when you're making decisions on what the next project is going to be of, I don't know, do you seek things out? Because it's really interesting when you look at the kind of, you know, the variety that you both work on as well. And Harry, you've got a couple of documentaries as well that are just, they're really, really lovely, beautiful things. And score has become such an important part of documentaries, I think, much more so in the last maybe 10 years, I think, than ever before. And particularly with nature and things around animals and things like that. I think with the, you know, things like Blue Planet and Green Planet and all those kind of things, they've kind of really highlighted how important the music can be in these shows to really tell the narrative, really, I think, as well. But what kind of informs the, you know, the decisions or the journey that you want to go on as a composer?
Well, that certainly as concerns the nature docs that I've done. Really, that was kind of the head of music at the time, I think 7 years ago or something at Disney, Mitchell Leapy, since retired. But he said to me, I'd done so many Disney movies. He said to me, look, Harry, why don't you do one of our nature movies? Because I feel that you'd be really good at it. And I did this one called Monkey Kingdom, and I loved it. And the director of that, or the producer of that, went on to produce Penguin. So I did that one. And the director of Penguin then went on to direct the next one, the Polar Bear.
Polar
they
Bear.
Just keep asking me. And I, you know, they're lovely opportunities, but they're less documentaries than, if you think about it, than, I mean, they are documentaries, I suppose. They're
like non-animated Disney films.
Yeah. But yeah. So I think the appeal from a compositional point of view is that once, you know, you've got the narrator, the pictures and the music, there's no, You know, there's no battle with gunfire or mad dialogue.
That's interesting. Do you think, because Catherine Keener obviously does a voice for Polar Bear, yeah. Does that inform the music for you?
Well, very much. Actually, to be honest with you, the way that it happens is that they have the film editor or even an actress a scratch voiceover. Mm-hmm. And they only when the film's very nearly done. So I pretty much composed the score by then. Only when it's very, very nearly done do they get, you know, they go and hire, in this instance, it was Catherine Keener. Yeah. So she's already saying the words that I know are going to be said.
Yeah.
She'll say them at a slightly different pace, which sometimes can trip me up. So I'm, whereas there might be a big downbeat after, I think it's going to land after a sentence.
That's interesting though, isn't it? The timbre of, I mean, if they were to hire Morgan Freeman, for instance, to come along, and he has that beautiful timbre to his voice, that would probably affect your score. You know, if you knew if he had his dialogue.
Well, Roots, like with anything, within this, there's adjustments needs to be made at the very, you know, down the back straight. Yeah. We do in a slightly different way.
The variation of the score is the spice of life for me anyway. Is going from an animation to a dark TV show like Behind Her Eyes you mentioned, and then to a superhero movie or something, and then doing doing the jazz part of a TV show when Harry's doing.
What was the jazz part of a TV? Is that what you told me you were doing it with a broken upright bass and an upright?
No. Well, I was referring to Catch 22, but yeah, I'm doing a score at the moment, which is just bass and percussion, really.
What is that?
Which is fun. I mean, it's called Brothers. Yeah.
Oh, it is. How apt.
Yeah, it is called Brothers.
You didn't ask me.
Surely that would have been obvious for your third thing to do together.
They did ask me to ask you. I forgot.
have you done Aquaman already?
No, that's October scoring.
That's in progress, right? You're in it.
Yeah, I'm really in it. I'm loving it, actually. Yeah, it's got a good baddie, and I like a good baddie. Yeah.
And, who's that?
Can't tell you.
But it's a good one.
And it's lovely getting the synths out as well. So I've really been enjoying doing that. It's great.
What informs those decisions? Like, I'm going to do synth, or I'm going to go with the double bass, or at what point are you kind of thinking about the instrumentation? Is it character? Is it narrative? Is it? I don't know where and when.
I mean, with the double bass, it's literally just the characters as a lumbering character who wants to do a heist, and I just felt the double bass. He's quite a big chap, and I just thought that suited him. And a heist is, you know, obviously double bass suits it, and plus I'm really shit at the double bass, which is good because he's lumbering. So it's sort of it's a nice mixture. And then with Aquaman, it's an underwater. It's sort of the Jean-Michel Jarre-ness of it all, you know, all the bubbles and squeals and stuff. It just suits it down to the ground.
I've got something I can relate to with the double bass. The on the original Shrek that John Powell and I did, so we eventually came up with a Shrek theme between us. And actually, that was the main theme. It didn't turn out to be the main theme, but the one theme that John and I actually co-wrote together. I think I wrote bee da dee da dum, and he wrote bee da da dum. He wrote the answer in his phrase. It was very cute. And we carried on like that. So anyhow, I said to him, look, listen, before Katzenberg comes for the meeting, I've got my friend Martin Tillman, my best buddy. He'll come, he plays cello, come in and you know, doo da da da. At least we have something live. And John's like, why don't you ask him to bring a double bass? And I said, he didn't bloody play a double bass. He doesn't own one. He said, ask him to bring a double bass. So I called Martin. I said, look, Martin, can you play the double bass? He said, I've never tried. I'm sure I won't be able to. I mean, I probably could do something. So he came in and he played it all lumpy and kind of wrong. And it was perfect for Shrek.
Amazing.
That you've said. Yeah. Thank you, John.
My kids, I mean, I love the Shrek films. It's obviously because the Scottish nature of Shrek. Any time we see our heritage celebrated in any form, it's like, yes, that's mine. Yeah. And what's so lovely is that my kids have levitated towards it, and they still love watching those films, kind of and reciting them, and you know, in the morning I'm making waffles and all that kind of stuff. Brilliant! It's just like. It's
I'm
so lovely.
Yeah.
Oh, donkey, look at his wee boots, you know, for when when Puss Boots turns up and stuff. They're really timeless films. They're really lovely to watch over and over and over again. And you've both had that opportunity to work on films like that, that are, they kind of almost regenerate in a way, I think. That's a lovely thing to be part of.
Yeah, my kids actually like one of your animations better than most of mine, Ruth. What's the first one that you did?
Over the Hedge.
Over the Hedge. I think. Well, that's the guy. They love that film. Mm. Oh, no. And my older children like the Bee Movie a lot.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's just because of Bumbles or the score. but they do. Jessie loves. She loves a bit of Bee Movie.
Enjoyed working together? Has it been a nice experience?
Yeah.
Why has it taken so long?
Well, bear in mind that the Gilded Age has been a really pleasant experience. You know, we had our shaky moment, which happened at the beginning, which would happen if we were, you know, working separately anyhow.
Yeah.
You know, which is always that not quite knowing where you're going with it. But as soon as we knew this kind of language of the thing, it was, as I say, it was a benefit. It was a huge benefit to have another, you know, somebody else. I mean, in my case, I'd go to bed and I knew there was an elf working away in the UK, you know, so that the work never stopped. And I assume that's how Rupert felt. Because we
it's funny that it is like a relay. Yeah. Because you have moments, you have surges
of creativity at midnight.
And hopefully they link. Yeah.
How was the experience for you, Rupert?
I loved it. It was good. It could have been terrible, you know, because working with it, could have been better. No, but it could have been awful. I mean,
you were just looking for the could have been a disaster.
I was thinking, no, well, it could have been less fun because we found the language pretty quickly. Yeah. I mean, Harry says you stumbled for probably a day or two. It was all with Catch as well. But maybe it's because we make a good team. But on Catch, we kind of got it first time. George was. Yeah. Really happy, and just had a great time. So it kind of works. It works well because we have and we have a bit of honesty with each other, which is a good thing.
I wish he would do more as a filmmaker, George. I just think that he's got such a great... Yeah. I don't know, I just think he's a great storyteller.
He is, but let's face it, he's got his composer. Monsieur Desplat not giving that up.
Right.
Yeah, I think we wheedled in there just because he must have been busy. He had to have been busy. He had to. What else has George ever used? Has he ever made anything without Desplat? I don't know. I don't
know. Desplat.
We're grateful for... It was a great thing.
I had to do a Q&A with a lot of the cast for Catch 22 and the producers and George at, I think it was at the View Westfield in London, where they had a kind of special screening of it for press and stuff. It might be the longest Q&A of like of number of people that I've ever had to wrangle. It was kind of, it went on into the horizon.
All the boys, all the boys who are in the,
so many people. Wow. It was unbelievable. But he's got such a good energy, and he's got such a great, you know, he's a showman, and he just knows how to work a room and work, whether it's one person or whether it's, you know, 100 people. He just, I don't know, it's almost like he reads the energy in the room and knows exactly what's required.
He's definitely one of the good guys. Yeah, we were lucky to do that. But we, you know, we felt really lucky to be doing The Gilded Age, because, you know, you know, it's obviously something Julian put his heart into for probably quite a few years, and imagined the concept and getting it all done at HBO. So we're really happy about that. And hey, Roo, have you been asked to do the second series?
Is this where the Wi-Fi suddenly breaks?
They want to go in a different direction, a singular direction.
That's nice.
No, it's but like it's funny. Electrics. It's funny.
One of the cars just comes off the track.
I always find that it's a, you know, you work with directors. Obviously, there's a trust thing when we have relationships with directors that we work with multiple times. But when you work with a director for the first time, they hire you. They've been on the film for 2 or 3 years. It's a labor of love, or it's a major thing for them, and they hire you, and they're kind of handing their baby to you. I always find that the trust, I mean, that's such a big thing for them, because we can really make it great, or we can make it something less than great.
But isn't that always the case?
It is the case, but music especially. I mean, you can get rid of an editor quickly, not that you'd want to, but, you know, a composer, I don't know. It takes a little time to realize whether they're working for you or not.
It's true what you say about that, you know, about being trusted with something. I remember when Ridley sent me the script, Ridley Scott sent me the script for The Martian, which it was way after he'd shot it. He was way into post-production, so he knew what he had. He just had written on it, read it, do it, don't F it up. Wow. Like, okay, I got a great film here. Just don't mess it up.
Wow.
Okay, thanks for that vote of confidence, Ridley. I'll try not to.
Great film. Listen, we run out of time, but it's quite funny because I was just going to ask you what is coming next, and you're both kind of basically submerging yourself both again in water with projects, which is good. I like that. One of you's kind of saving the earth, the other one's kind of, you know, sort of slightly destructive, more of a destructive manner about it, the character. Yeah. But I'm very excited to watch the second incarnations of both those films. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what they both are, but we've already mentioned Aquaman and Harry Meg 2, which we know Ben Wheatley's directing, and I love that marriage of Ben Wheatley and Meg 2. That is, I'm booking a ticket as soon. Through,
apparently, Edith's first, very first our podcast was with Ben Wheatley, the director of the Meg 2. I was just with.
Is that right?
Yeah. Very first guest on the show.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Nice.
We have a lot to thank him for.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful man, as are you two. This has been so nice. I hope you've had a nice time.
Yeah,
yeah, lovely.
And I look forward to chatting to you both individually for all these projects that are coming up. And there's so much there for people to kind of dive into if they haven't. I mean, Catch 22, if people haven't seen that, they really should, because I just thought it was a fantastic show for so many reasons as well. And also really moved by Polar Bear, I've got to say, Harry. I just thought it was...
Oh, thank you.
Really moving and thoroughly entertained by The Gilded Edge as well. I just love Julian's take on that kind of New York high society. It's really brilliant, and your score complements it brilliantly. Harry and Rupert, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me. And take care. And I look forward to chatting to you again. Thank you so much.
From The Score to George Clooney's Catch 22, that's back in the air, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Harry and Rupert Gregson-Williams. If you haven't seen Catch 22 yet, go and seek it out. I thought it was wonderful. My huge thanks to Harry and Rupert for taking the time to talk to us. The Gilded Age is available on various platforms, including Sky, Now TV and HBO Max. If you want to hear my previous chat with Harry, or indeed my many conversations with the aforementioned Ben Wheatley, head to edithbowman.com, where you'll also be able to drop us an email. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do keep telling your pals about us if you like what you hear. Next up, now you might have heard about this new film that is hitting cinemas around the world, Top Gun Maverick. How would you like to hear from legendary producer Jerry Bruckheimer and director Joseph Kosinski? Jerry and Joe are my guests on Soundtracking next week. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. Highway to the danger zone. Oh yeah, we talk danger zone.